We are doing a deep dive today into really the foundations of publish adventure content.
Yeah, this is an excavation.
It is. We're looking at the source material that basically defines scenario design in the late 80s. We've got excerpts from TSR's Dungeon Adventures magazine issue number 1 from 88, and even a bit from a late 87 issue.
And our mission here really is to unpack the structure, the ambition, and just the sheer creativity in these early modules for D&D and AD&D.
Right.
Because what you see right away is that TSR wasn't just, you know, pushing out content. They were recognizing this massive well of creativity that was already out there with players and dungeon masters.
And they gave it a dedicated home. This magazine wasn't full of articles about playing. It was just the modules.
Just scenarios.
Complicated ones, too, sent in by readers and then curated by the editors.
The scope was just incredibly ambitious for a new magazine. You see everything here. Classic dungeon crawls, sure, but also wilderness survival stuff, material for oriental adventures, even scenarios for the battle system rules.
A one-stop shop for inspiration. It sounds like they knew they had a hit on their hands, but the name must have been a challenge. I mean, they already had the hugely successful Dragon magazine.
Oh, the notes on the naming process are fascinating. They went through dozens of options.
Like what?
Brilliant names, really. Things like Wyrm, Labyrinth, Tesseract, even Quest and Oracle.
I can see Wyrm. It's a great companion to Dragon.
It is, but yeah. They wanted something that I think got to the heart of the game's identity.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, they landed on Dungeon.
Obvious in retrospect.
It was the obvious and perfect complement to Dragon. That was the thinking. It immediately tells you what it's about, the place of adventure. It was just perfect.
Okay, let's unpack one of their first really ambitious designs. It's a module called Assault on Eddiston Point. Low-level adventure, right? First to third level characters.
Right.
But the plot is pure high-stakes trade. International intrigue, almost.
The setting is everything here. You're in the old Crystals Mountains, this vital trade route between two big city-states, Untala and Stafferberg. And the key thing to know is that this area only just found peace about 50 years ago after a brutal trade war.
So it's a fragile peace.
Very. And to keep things stable, they set up this signal system. 8 towers, like Eddiston Point, stretching across the mountains.
And this isn't just smoke signals we're talking about.
No. It's way more advanced. They use flashing mirrors during the day and these continual light spell boxes at night.
To do what?
To communicate market prices, specifically for gold. Almost instantly across the mountains. It's basically a medieval commodities exchange run on magic.
Wow. Okay, so that flips the script on the usual go kill some goblins in a cave quest.
And here's the twist. The tower was seized by bandits, but they were hired guns. The real villain is an illusionist named Voronia da Concri.
Who's disguised as an old man named Voro, which is a classic move. But who's her employer?
A major merchant family back in Untala. And their goal isn't to steal treasure from the tower.
It's to steal information.
Exactly. They want to intercept the real-time gold prices and then send a fake message to Stafferberg.
So it's corporate espionage.
It's pure white-collar crime in a fantasy setting. The goal, and this is a direct quote, is to subtly favor return business for the Untala family. It's such a sophisticated motivation for a first-level adventure.
And the whole mission is urgent because the mayor, Edmund, is terrified that the moment this fog lifts, the bandits will send that false message and reignite the trade war. The stakes are huge.
And it feels very personal, too, when you look at who's been captured. You've got Delia the White, a magic user. She sent a message out with her familiar, but then they found her and drugged her.
And what about the others?
Then there's Harold, a dwarf warrior.
Yeah.
He insulted the half-orcs, so they beat him badly and shoved him down the stable drainage hole.
The drainage hole.
Yeah, you find him down there, barely conscious. It really grounds the whole thing. It's a grubby, dangerous job.
And the bandit leader, Scalf, is no joke. He apparently tries to kill any elves on sight.
And Voronia, the illusionist, she's already killed 2 guards with a phantasmal force spell. An illusion so real, it can actually kill you.
So you have to deal with the negotiations, stealth, finance, and some really lethal enemies, all at level 1.
Looks like they were trying to blend classic fantasy with a Tom Clancy novel.
Amazing. Okay, let's pivot from that to the complete opposite end of the spectrum. High-level play, Into the Fire.
Right, this is for 6th to 10th level characters. And if the last one was about finance, this is all about lost royalty and a very, very smart dragon.
So the mystery kicks off 15 years after this 9-year-old Prince Lumeran disappeared. Everyone thought he was lost at sea.
Until his silver necklace, the one with the royal seal, suddenly shows up. A dying knight named Sir Huger brings it out of the mountains, warning about fire or flames with his last breath.
And the backstory is just layers upon layers.
It's incredible. The prince wasn't lost at sea. He was sold into slavery by a pirate. The necklace eventually made its way into the hoard of a dragon named Flame.
Flame. A subtle name.
And the module notes he was actually more annoyed about losing his dinner, Sir Huger, who escaped in a blizzard, than he was about the knight stealing the necklace.
So he's not just a monster. He's a calculating creature, and he has magic user spells.
Oh, yeah. Haste. Polymorph other. And his lair shows you just how tactical he is.
Okay, where is he?
In a volcanic region near a heated lake called Crater Lake. And crucially, he has an amulet that makes him immune to scrying or any kind of location spell.
Wow. So the dragon has operational security. You can't just use magic to find him.
Exactly. So how do you even begin to approach that?
Very carefully, I'm guessing.
Very carefully. And you have to survive his traps. He has a whole sequence set up at his main entrance.
Let's walk through it. What's first?
First, he hits you with hallucinatory terrain. Makes the entrance corridor look like it stretches on forever. It's pure psychological warfare.
Okay, so you're disoriented. Then what?
Then, once your party moves in, he springs a combo trap. A pit opens up under you, and a portcullis slams down from above. It's designed to pin you, injure you, and bottleneck your entire party.
And the grand finale.
While you're stuck and trying to recover, he breathes fire straight down the corridor. Hits everyone. And as a bonus, the fire dispels the illusion. It's just a brutal, efficient party wipe maneuver.
Unbelievable. But the history here goes back even further, right?
Much further. The module also details the ruins of a wizard's tower that Flame destroyed 120 years ago. He just toppled it right into Crater Lake.
And inside?
Inside you find the wizard's bodyguard, Sir Frederick, a high-level cavalier trapped in his full plate armor, preserved underwater for over a century.
And he's got his sword.
He's got his intelligent, neutral good longsword plus three named Moronis. They're just waiting to be found. The amount of history packed into one submerged room is just staggering.
That attention to detail is amazing. Okay, so we've seen grand history and royal intrigue. Let's look at another low-level threat from a module called Grackert's Lair. It shows that organized humanoids can be just as deadly.
Right, and Grackert, the villain here, is another example of complex motivation. He's a chaotic, evil assassin and illusionist.
A nasty combination.
And he's the son of an even crueler illusionist, Aram, who is tied to this big assassin's guild. So Grackert is basically carrying on the family business of deceit and murder.
And he organized a raid.
A massive one. 150 Norkers. They hit a town called Nolivari, did a lot of damage before they were driven back. Mm. Now you're hunting him in his lair.
And what's that like?
It reflects his personality.
Mm.
It's organized but cruel. The Norker chieftain, Ragtam, he sits on this crude bed that's right on top of the tribal treasure chest.
Which is trapped, of course.
Of course. A poison needle. Doesn't kill you, but puts you in a coma for days.
Meanwhile, what's Grackert doing? He's not just sitting on a throne waiting for you, is he?
Not at all. He's a strategist. He uses a magical fountain on the lower level to scry on the party as you approach. He's studying your strengths, your weaknesses.
Gathering intel.
Exactly. Then he casts invisibility and blur on himself and prepares a surgical strike on whoever he thinks is your most powerful member. He's using low-level magic with high-level strategy.
And beyond the villains themselves, these modules were famous for their environmental hazards. They were almost monsters in their own right.
Absolutely correct. In Grackert's lair, for instance, there's brown mold. They use it for refrigeration, basically.
A practical purpose.
But if you get within 5 feet, it instantly freezes you for, you know, a ton of damage, a hazard that serves a purpose.
And what about that other one, the Guardians of the Tomb?
That module has razor weed. It covers this 5-foot-deep marshy moat around a shrine.
Mm-hmm.
If you fall in, the plants just shred you. It automatically inflicts maximum damage.
Brutal.
And that tomb itself has this classic consequence trap. The moment you touch the treasure inside, a wall of stone skull seals all the exits. You're trapped inside until dawn.
And I'm guessing you're not alone in there.
Not at all. Sealing the tomb also summons a legion of shadows.
Oof. Strength-draining undead. So you get the treasure, but only if you can survive the night against an enemy that makes you weaker with every single hit.
It's the perfect bait and switch.
The level of mechanical detail they give the DM is also pretty incredible.
Oh, totally. Like, the notes on fighting lava children in the Dark Tower of Kabalar, it explicitly says normal metal armor is useless against them. That forces you to completely rethink your defenses.
It forces creative thinking. Or what about that light bridge?
The weaving light bridge. You have to wait 2 full rounds for it to stabilize before you can cross.
Yeah.
It makes just moving from A to B a tactical decision.
And there are little rules everywhere. In Brockert's lair, on a wet corridor, you have to make a dexterity check every 10 feet, or you slip and take falling damage. They really got into the weeds.
They left nothing to chance.
But the rewards for navigating all this, they were substantial. And not just cash.
That's the key. For rescuing Prince Lomoran's crown, yeah, you get a share of 30,000 gold pieces. But the real prize, you can claim the dragon's empty tower as your new base of operations.
The cash funds the operation. The tower is the operation.
Exactly. And even in the low-level trade war scenario,
right,
you get a good payday for taking back Eddystone Point. But they throw in this little political wrinkle.
Right.
They hint that getting any more rewards out of the city-states will be tough unless you have clear physical evidence of the plot. So it pushes you to be a better investigator, not just a fighter.
And sometimes the treasures were just weird.
Oh, for sure. One adventure had these magical bubbles of energy gas in a hidden elven home.
Energy gas.
You pop one, you get temporary hit points and a temporary strength boost. It's a perfect little mid-adventure power-up, and it just adds this touch of surreal flavor.
It's fascinating. I mean, these early dungeon adventures weren't just maps and monsters. They were full narratives. They had historical context, political intrigue, personal vengeance.
They really set the standard for decades of complex storytelling in these games. They understood that the complexity itself could be the reward.
So what does this all mean for you listening to this? Well, these sources show how a complex motivation can anchor any fantasy quest. It doesn't matter if you're usurping a throne or manipulating gold prices.
The quest to find a missing message about commodities can be just as thrilling as hunting a dragon, as long as the stakes are high and the villains are smart.
Which leaves us with a final provocative thought. Grokrit's father, the evil illusionist Aram, he had these missing journals and spellbooks. They were supposedly stolen after he died.
And those books contained secrets that could be fatal to the Assassin's Guild he worked with.
So what kind of long-term, multi-session adventure could come from finding those scattered, incredibly sensitive secrets? Your first deep dive into a simple dungeon might just be the first step in a saga that lasts for decades.